Hello and welcome. This is The Art of Imagination with Tess from Jagged Edge Arts. Today I'll be speaking with author John Peel, whose work is so expansive that I'm frankly not even sure how to sum it up. To me, he'll always be the author of the kids' horror series Foul Play, which takes popular children's games and brings them to life as total nightmare fuel that haunted my childhood in the best way. He also wrote the two beloved fantasy series Dragonhome and Diadem, the Shocker's horror books, and I'm scared to even count how many others, but he's probably best known internationally for his novelizations and tie-ins of major sci-fi and adventure franchises, including Doctor Who, Star Trek, Quantum Leap, James Bond, Carmen Sandiego, and so many others. I've been an avid reader of his since the early 90s, and I'm so excited to be talking to him today. So, John, thank you for doing this. I have to say, I am absolutely astounded by the number of books you've published. How on earth did you end up with this crazy collection?
My philosophy of writing is, if it sounds like it'll be fun, I'll try it and see how it goes.
I think that's the best.
So I've done a lot of things I probably shouldn't have done or wouldn't have done, but I had great fun with them. So,
well, that's the main thing. You've clearly been involved and passionate about reading, and especially sci-fi, from a young age. I think you said since age 10, you were devouring these books nonstop.
Oh, yes. I remember going down to the public library, which was in England, and there was a children's room and there was an adult room, but we had an intermediate area, which, if they considered you were responsible enough, you could borrow books from. And I managed to get into that a little early, by about 2 years, and they had a lovely selection of science fiction there. So I just simply started at the A's and worked my way through it. Didn't always get good books that way, but it kept me on edge, and I knew where I had gotten to, at least.
So you just read literally anything?
Anything.
You didn't have a system for, like, oh, this looks like a good cover, or this looks like a good story. You just grabbed a book and started reading.
Well, at the time I started reading the things, the biggest publisher of science fiction in England was a firm called Gollancz. And Gollancz did all of their science fiction with yellow covers. And that was it. It was just yellow and the title and and the writer. So you weren't drawn by the covers because they were terrible. At the same time, I was buying books, of course, on my own. And those I was picking because they looked good. Or hopefully, if I was lucky, I would find one by a writer I'd already read. And then, of course, I could follow on with that writer. But when you're that young, you really don't have a lot of discrimination in your taste. You just devour everything. And then it's only later you look back and say, oh, that was pretty awful. or that was wonderful, you know.
Absolutely.
I mean, I discovered Robert Heinlein, for example, at a pretty young age. So that wasn't a bad start.
No, that's heavy stuff for young readers, though, for sure.
Well, yes, he wrote some juveniles, but they weren't published in England until I was about 20, so they were kind of pointless by that point. but I loved reading them anyway because they were just such good stories. And it was just the way things were then, back in those days. I'm sounding like a terribly old gentleman. No.
I've always felt that people seem to have this bizarre idea that books for a certain age should be kept to that age.
Right.
And some people seem surprised that I still read books that I loved when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. But to me, the writing style, you can acknowledge, like, okay, that's for younger readers. It's not War and Peace.
Right. Yeah.
But it's still like, if the premise is good, that doesn't change based on age.
No, I was doing some autobiographical stuff recently, and I was thinking of books I read when I was a kid. And I thought, what the heck? Promptly went online and bought copies of some of them. And I sat down to reread them. And honestly, the ones that I remember from that age, most of them are really good. They're cleverly written, they're imaginative, and they're really something worthwhile.
Exactly.
So I don't think there's anything wrong with reading books that are meant for children as an adult, or in fact, the other way around. My grandfather would read books, and he would throw them in this cupboard he had, and then when I went over to see him, he'd say, oh yeah, take anything you like, you know, whatever's in there that looks good for you. And I would just take everything. I mean, literally everything that he'd been reading. Some of them were good. I remember that was where I first read James Bond, for example.
Oh, wow.
But then some of the books were just terrible. And the plots didn't make a lot of sense to me because they were way above my age grade. But I read them anyway. I didn't care. So even if I didn't understand them entirely, it was still reading as far as I was concerned.
No, I think that's great. I think there's too much focus nowadays on, oh, kids should read this stuff. Adults should read this stuff. And I think kids miss out now because they're being kind of sheltered from more mature books that people are saying, oh, they're not ready for it. I read a lot of stuff that I technically wasn't ready for, and then I just read it again later and got more out of it.
Right. I mean, the bits you don't understand, you kind of bleep over and you sort of think, oh, you know, okay. And then when you go back and reread it again, you think to yourself, what was I thinking back then? But I wasn't really thinking. I was just reading. It was just a way of gaining stuff. It made me happy. You know? I didn't care.
I know you said you had anemia as a child, and so you had a lot of time to sit around and read.
Yes, yes. I wasn't allowed to do sports while I was in school because I would faint or whatever, you know. So the teachers tend to frown on that sort of thing. And they would just let me sit inside and read books instead, which, as far as I was concerned, was perfect. I was having a great time. And since I was the only one not in sports, I had a nice, peaceful classroom to sit and read in. So as a result of which, I was happy, and I read all kinds of things. We had a great selection of odds and ends being published back then, which they certainly wouldn't do these days. We had the English comics, are not like American comics. English comics tended to be mostly sort of black and white collections of short pieces that are probably one or two pages long. And they would be published every week. So you would have installments. And I can remember some of them very clearly, even though I haven't read them in 50 years, which shows they made an impact on me, even though at the time I was just reading them for fun. I don't know what the name of it was, but one comic had this thing about an American riverboat in the early West traveling up and down the Mississippi and getting involved in adventures. And they would be doing stupid things like riding ostriches or zebras in the American West.
We do that here, you know.
Yeah. Absolute madness, but great fun. I love those things.
That sounds wonderful.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you get used to the craziest ideas. So once I started writing, I didn't think it was crazy to come up with some of the concepts I did because they were the kind of things I was reading back then.
That's great.
Certainly better than taking drugs anyway.
Well, for sure. I mean, I was that kid that they started kicking me out of the library in middle school, I think, because I spent 6th, 7th, 8th grade pretty much every recess or lunchtime. I'd just go to the library and sit in a corner with a book. And they were like, go out and play.
Yeah, me too.
But speaking of stuff that made an impact, I know this is old for you at this point, but huge fan of the Foul Play series. And, you know, I was born in 84. I think those came out in like 92, 93. Mm-hmm. And I read them when they first came out and I was just hooked. And I was always so sad there were only 4 of them. Looking back now, even though I'm like, okay, the writing style is younger, they're geared towards younger people, but I still appreciate the ideas. Those concepts were brilliant to me. I really thought they were so, so clever. And so creepy, and but just genius. Like the idea of taking these 4 games and making them into horror books for kids. Did you come up with one and then think, okay, I'll sit down and consider what other games I can do? Or
yeah, what happened was a lady called Bernice Chartier came to me and she said she had this idea for children's games gone wrong or children's games in the Twilight Zone. But she really hadn't thought much about it apart from that. And she asked me, you know, can you do something with this? And I thought it was a clever idea, you know, the whole concept itself. And I came up with a plot for Hangman to begin with. And I suggested, I gave her the outlines and she loved it. So we did that one and she had somehow, in between coming up with the concept and my finishing writing one, she had sold the series to Penguin. They said, oh, well, we want several books, not just one book. We want several. So They ended up asking for four, so I was on the hook for three more books, basically. I remember coming out with a list of like 10 or 12 ideas, games that we could use, because I wanted to obviously keep the name of the game in the book.
Yeah, yeah.
So we wanted games that would sound like catchy titles, even if we were cheating a little bit with, like, Tag, You're Dead.
I was surprised it wasn't Freeze Tag.
Well, the problem again here is because I didn't play sports and when I was growing up, I couldn't think of many games that we could use. And Bernice only had a few ideas, and she would come up with them and give me the idea, well, what about this, what about that? And half the time I hadn't heard of the games at all, so I had no idea what the game was. But we settled on the four and worked through those first. But it was great fun. I mean, as I say, her concept was simply games go wrong. So she left it to me to decide what the games were and how they were going to go wrong. It was just very freeing. I had this, you know, the opportunity to do almost anything I wanted, which is always dangerous when you're a writer because it doesn't always work.
Well, it did in this case.
I had a terrible editor on those books.
Oh, that's too bad.
I've only ever had really one bad editor, and it was this one. She didn't have much of a sense of humor, and I do. I constantly write jokes into everything. I can't help it. Even if it's a serious book, I'll write a joke in or something. And she was constantly cutting my jokes. It was just the fact that I would see things as funny, and she just didn't get the point, didn't get the whole joke at all. In Simon Says, for example, the heroine's friend is turned into a kitten.
Vicky, yes, I was just going to mention that.
So the heroine takes the kitten home with her and says to the mother, I've got to look after this cat. So the mother says, well, all right, but we're laying down some ground rules here. First of all, it only eats cat food. And the cat's in the background going, about the whole concept, because it's really a girl. And then the second one was, oh, she has to sleep in the kitchen or whatever. The cat's looking kind of funny about that. And then from my point of view, the whole point of the joke comes when the mother says, and as soon as she's old enough, she's going to have to be neutered.
Oh, no.
And then the mother says, I think there's something wrong with your cat. I think he's fainting, which I thought was hysterical. But Tish didn't get it, so that's not actually in the book.
I do remember that scene very well.
The punchline is missing.
You adapted. That aside, they're still fantastic books. You should see my copies of them. I don't have them right here with me, but they're falling apart. I've read them so many times over the years.
Well, that's good to hear. I have a few books myself that I've read so often that they've had to be replaced.
My Narnia books are held together by rubber bands.
Yeah, Narnia, of course. And another one I absolutely adored, my wife introduced me to Diana Wynne Jones, who writes wonderful fantasies. I absolutely adored her. I actually wrote to her when I was editing a magazine and told her I was going to be doing a little piece on her in the next issue. And she was very thrilled. And I was like, no, I'm thrilled because you did all these wonderful books. And I'd written to ask if she had a photograph that I could use. And she sent me this photograph of herself in a Halloween harem costume, which was absolutely hysterical. It was just really funny costume. So we ran that with the article, which was just terrific. She had a lovely sense of humor, which helped.
Yeah, well, that does help. I feel like even in serious books, having that sense of humor is nice. It doesn't have to cheapen the darker stuff. It can add to it.
Well, my latest book, in fact, I've done that kind of thing with. It's a book called Unstoppable. The idea is, what if people came back from the dead? I mean, literally, the way that they had died, they just come back. And there's no rhyme or reason to it. It just might be anybody. In between the chapters of the actual story, I have little vignettes of the people coming back from the grave. And there's one section, for example, where this girl dies of a blood disease in middle of Europe. And she's going home again. And the neighbors will see her and think she's a vampire because she's come back from the grave. So they stake her out. You know, she comes back, she's thinking, oh, good, I'm wonderful. I'm alive and I'm well. And bam, through the heart, you know, which is horrible and funny at the same time, which is something I tend to do. So there's a few pieces like that. But the book itself is mostly serious. But then again, I throw in an alien taxi driver, for example, who just doesn't understand what all the problems with these humans are. So, as I say, I can't write a book without putting some humor into it. It's the way I am. It wouldn't work without some humor somewhere.
That's a wonderful quirk to have, something you just enjoy throwing into your work.
Oh, yeah, very much so. The only time, though, an editor actually told me to put more jokes into a book was when I was doing books based on Carmen Sandiego. And my editor said, as many jokes as you can, put them in. This is for that kind of an audience. It was one of the happiest jobs in my career, and it was one of the first, so it was a good start to my career.
How did you get involved in the tie-in books? I know you're obviously a big Doctor Who fan.
Well, yeah, that really is, oddly enough, almost everything that happened in my life has happened because of Doctor Who, which is very strange, but true. One of my favorite books was David Whittaker's original Doctor Who novel from 1964. That's one of the ones I've replaced about five times because I've read it so often. And I just loved the way he'd written. And I thought, wow, this is what I want to do. And I met the editor of a magazine from England called Doctor Who. It was then called Doctor Who Weekly. And I told him, oh, I could write stories for you. Give me a chance. And he said, oh, all right then, John, why not? And he says, send me some ideas and we'll see what we can do. And it was literally that easy. I sent him some ideas in, and he was just such a nice guy that he paid attention to me. He read the things and he liked several of the ideas. And he said, okay, let's take this one first. Have you ever written any comic strips before? And I said, well, no, this is my first try. So he sent me one of his own scripts as an example of how to write it and how to lay it out and everything, and went through it all with me. He was very patient, wonderful editor. And then he bought the story. So it was literally, that was a weird way in, but it worked.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And I moved to America again because of Doctor Who. My wife was a Doctor Who fan over here, and we'd become pen pals back in the days before computers and what have you. We'd gotten married, and I moved to America. And I was writing articles for magazines over here, mostly nonfiction. And St. Martin's Press asked me if I could do a book for them, because they decided, since I was writing these magazine articles, I knew enough about Doctor Who to write a book on it for them. So as a result of that, I got in touch with Dalek creator Terry Nation to work with him on the book. So we were doing this, the official Doctor Who and the Daleks book together. And in England, there's a company called Target who was publishing novels based on the TV stories of Doctor Who. And they were from the original scripts. And Terry had not been very happy with the last couple of books that had been done. He thought they weren't quite as good as he wanted them. And he'd refused to let them do any more. So they called him up again and said, please, Terry, you know, can we have some more of your stories? And Terry said, well, all right then, but on one condition, John Peel has to write them.
Nice.
They didn't care, because as long as they got the books, they were happy. So they didn't care really who wrote them. So they said, yep, sure, whatever you want. So he called me up and said, John, would you like to write a novel? And I said, well, yeah, of course I would. Why? He said, well, I've just got you a contract.
Wow.
It was literally like that. That's what happened. And I wrote my first novel. Well, my second novel. I was writing my first original novel at the time for a different editor, one over here. And she was, again, one of these wonderful editors, Olga Litowinski. And she knew what she wanted, and she knew I could do it. But I would write my pieces, and then she would say, "This doesn't work. Change it." And then I'd say, "Well, change it how?" And she'd say, "You're the writer. You change it." And she forced me to look at my writing in a new way, so that I could actually improve what I was doing. So all the time I'm writing this novel, Terry's lined me up to write several others. And I ended up having to put that on one side to keep, to work on the Doctor Who books. But it was tremendous fun. And then somehow I got an agent at that point, and she got me more work as well. In fact, she was the one that brought Bernice to me with the foul play concept. And I was just writing like crazy for there was one year I wrote 14 books.
Oh, my God.
Which was a little much.
That's amazing.
I really probably shouldn't have done it, but I was just having so much fun. I wasn't stopping. It was just tremendous fun. That was the whole thing. I was just enjoying myself so much.
But what a wonderful way to actually launch into that career and do something you love
so
much.
I know. It was something I wanted to do, but I hadn't got a clue about how to go about it. So Terry had actually done most of the work for me setting it up, which was amazing. And it was a great experience. Terry was the most amazing person. He's very, very generous. As a result of which, he had this terribly, terribly aggressive agent. He needed Roger Hancock, because Terry would quite happily let you do anything. You want to do that? Yeah, sure, go ahead, John. And Roger was there to kind of bring him back to earth and say, no, you can't do that. I think he thought at first that I was taking advantage of Terry, and he was kind of against me. But after a while, he mellowed, and we got along famously. But Terry really needed an agent that would really look after him, and that's what Roger was doing. And my agent was doing the same for me. In fact, funny story here about foul play. While I was doing the foul plays and having problems with Tish, my agent had to negotiate something with Bernice about the series. And Bernice got very upset, and she called me up and said, "John, that agent of yours, she's a real dragon." And I said, "Well, I there are times when I need a dragon, thank you." And I told my agent this, and she had hysterics. She thought it was the most funny thing anybody had ever said to her. And as a result of which, when Christmas came around, I got a little package from my agent. I opened it up, and there's this little dragon holding a candle for Christmas, because she loved it so much. The publishing world is full of odd things that happen like that.
Well, it's important that you have people to have your back. I feel, especially in literature, I think writers, I feel, are often undervalued and taken advantage of, not as respected off the bat. So,
well, the thing is, a lot of people figure, oh, well, I could write a story. I mean, they think, well, I haven't done, but I could. Whereas they, they don't think the same about other professions. So as a result of which, they tend to think that writers are just people. It's like a clerk in the office. They come in the morning, do their work, and go home, and that's it. And they're 9 to 5, get paid for the job they do, and that's not really what writers do, of course. But it's how a lot of people view writers in the industry. I know in publishing terms, some of the publishers are dreadful with their attitude to writers. I was writing at one time for Simon & Schuster. I had, a lovely, lovely editor, Patricia McDonald. And Pat was very, very wonderful to work with. There was myself. There was R.L. Stein. There was Christopher Pike.
You're listing all of my childhood favorites.
Right.
Here.
Well, we were all writing the same kind of story, teenage horror stories. We were all happy about it. Working with Pat. Pat was lovely to work with. She was a lovely lady and treated us very well. So we were all happy. And then somebody new came in at Simon & Schuster and decided they would only keep R.L. Stein, they literally fired the whole range of writers except for Stein. And the funny part about that is Stein quit about 6 months later. So they had no writers of
that's fantastic.
Serve them right.
I mean, I love Stein. I've read every Goosebumps and Fear Street book. When I was talking about sitting in the library in middle school, I mean, that was half of what I was reading. But, you know, like your work, Christopher Pike, I mean, he had some amazing ones that were so disturbing, but so great.
It's the way some people treat writers, as if they're disposable. You know, get rid of one writer, well, we'll just get another one, no big deal.
I'd like to say that it seems like it's changed. Now I think it's probably even worse, to be honest, with AI. People are putting in prompts and, oh, I've written a story.
I know. I steer clear of AI.
It's the worst.
I just enjoy my stories, so I would be lost without writing them.
I think that's a sentiment most writers understand. Obviously, you do a lot of your own work as well, but when it comes to the tie-in books, is it that somebody comes to you and kind of commissions you to do it, or are there things that you look at and you're like, well, I really want to do that, and you pitch it to them? Because you've done Doctor Who, Star Trek, like you said, Carmen Sandiego, and Quantum Leap, all these shows.
Well, they're all different. For example, the Outer Limits, when I did the Outer Limits, 12 of them, they came to me and said, can you do these? And me being me said, sure, yeah, no problem. I've only ever gone to companies twice in my career and said, please, please, please let me write one of your books. And the Quantum Leap was one of them. I just loved the show. And when they started publishing the books, I went to the editor, Ginger Buchanan, and I said to her, please let me write one. Let me write one. I love this show. So she graciously said, well, send me an outline and we'll see what we can do. And I came up with this brilliant idea for a Quantum Leap novel in which Sam Beckett gets killed in chapter one. And then they have to go back and save his life. And it's his wife that goes back to save him. And I pitched this idea to Ginger. And Ginger just looked at me and said, we couldn't do that. People read these books for Sam. And you've only got him in like chapter one and chapter 20. You know, she said the fans would kill me if we published this. So she then said, why don't you do a story where he jumps into his own timeline, his ancestors, which they did one episode of on TV. And she thought it was great. So she suggested I do that, having him jump into a previous Sam Beckett. I liked the sound of that, so we went with it. So that was one book where I actually went to them and said, please, please, please let me do it. The other one was for, I don't know if you remember, a TV show called Alienation.
I do.
Yes, I just adored that show. It was so clever. And I went, in this case, it was to Simon Schuster, who I was writing for at the time anyway. So I went to the editor there and said, please, can I do an Alienation? And he said, yeah, sure, no problem. This was after they had cancelled it, but they were planning on doing a second season. So there were a lot of scripts already written. And he sent me a script for, you know, prospective second season and everything. And I thought, oh, this is cool. I really like this one. I'd love to do it. And we got right to the stage where I was about to sign the contracts. He was just getting them ready for me to sign. And they cancelled the series.
Oh, no.
He felt really bad about this because he'd convinced me to do the book in the first place and got me all enthusiastic. And he said to me, sorry about that, John, but have you ever thought about doing a Star Trek novel? And I said, well, no, I haven't, actually. It never occurred to me. And, I mean, I like Star Trek, but I just never thought of doing one. After I rang off, I thought to myself, you know, what if I did write a Star Trek story? What would I do? And then the next morning, I called him up and said, can I change my answer to that question you asked me yesterday? I'd love to do a Star Trek book. And he liked the outline, so that was how I got to do Star Trek. But I hadn't intended to. It was just one of these things that they had asked me, and I realized I wanted to, after all. So it's really fun.
I loved the Star Trek ones, but what Doctor Who was to you, Star Trek was to me, the original series and the Next Generation especially. I saw the other spinoffs obviously later on, But to me, that was my childhood. I was there in front of the TV. I had an entire shelf with all of the original series VHS tapes, like just each episode on one cassette. I would put them on all the time. And that was my life. Like, I lived and breathed Star Trek.
Oh, I had them. I recorded them all every week as well. And this is the funny thing. I love Star Trek, but it had never occurred to me to write it. It was just a mental block, I guess. I don't know. Also, I guess I really didn't think my sense of humor would go over too well at times.
I don't know. Star Trek's got good humor.
Oh, yeah, just a bit. But they let me actually put a bit of humor in my books, so I was happy.
You did Next Generation and Deep Space Nine,
Deep Space
right?
Nine.
Writing about Bajor.
Yeah. Deep Space Nine was, I think, my favorite. It wasn't like the other Star Treks set on one spaceship going boldly where no one had gone before or something. They were sitting around and the universe was coming to them, basically. It kind of turned the normal Star Trek on its head. And I like that. I like the idea of playing with that. So I really enjoyed doing Deep Space Nine stories. But then again, I also enjoyed doing the Next Gen stories. My only rule, as I say, for writing my books is it's got to be fun. It's got to be something that I'm going to enjoy. I wouldn't write books on shows that I don't watch or I don't care about or anything. It has to be something that I've got a connection to.
Right, because otherwise you're not as invested and that creative fatigue can set in.
Well, you know, this is the thing. Somebody, in fact, over the weekend said to me, well, how do you discipline yourself to write? He said, do you get up in the morning and say, I've got to write 500 words today or what? And I said, well, no. I get up in the morning thinking, oh boy, I've got another chapter to do today. And I said, that's what keeps me going. That's why I don't have writer's block or anything, because I'm so happy to be doing what I'm doing. It makes me happy to be allowed to play effectively, sometimes with my own characters, sometimes with other people's. But either way, as long as it's going to be fun, you know, why not? How can you get a better job than that? Writing characters and settings that you love and getting paid for it. I mean,
I don't think you can. I don't think there's a better job, but then again, I'm biased.
Certainly not for me anyway. I'm terrible at doing other things. So it's a good job I can write.
I 100% relate to that. Writing is something that I've done since I was so young and I've loved it. I wrote my first full-length book when I was in fifth grade on a typewriter. And it was a murder mystery. And I'm not going to say it was an amazing book because I was in fifth grade. But, you know, it was still like that was something that I knew I was so passionate about early on. And I feel like you just know it. And if you love it, you love it. And you have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's kind of like an addiction. You can't wean yourself away from it. If you're meant to be a writer, you just have to sit down and write. In almost all cases, as you just said, it starts when you're young. You can't help it. One of the things about the internet is I've reconnected with some people from my own childhood. And one of them actually sent me some pages from the school magazine from, oh, goodness, whenever. Anyway, when I was about 14, and I had completely forgotten I'd written a short story for it. And, of course, it was science fiction. What else? And it was published in the school magazine back then. And I'd forgotten about it long ago, lost the magazines, but he had kept his and he photocopied the page and sent it to me. And that was quite something. But I mean, I had been writing back then.
That's great that they still had that and sent it to you.
Yeah. I mean, we're talking about 50 years ago. I'm amazed I can remember it. It was where I began, and it's interesting to see it still from now. I mean, obviously, it's not professional writing. It's just fun writing. But I can see where a lot of my wackiness is still there and my crazy ideas and stuff. I can remember some stories I wrote back as a child. One of my favorite editors that I ever worked with is a guy called Craig Walker. And Craig and I saw eye to eye on almost everything. We used to sit and swap stories about the stories and things like that. And he was an editor who knew stories. If he ever made a suggestion, it would help the story. Whereas some editors will give you suggestions that just really would not work. Whereas Craig knew me. He called me up one day and he said to me, John, can you write Jane Eyre with dragons?
Dragonholm.
Jane Eyre with dragons. The next morning I had a complete outline ready for him and sent it to him. Because that was all he had to say, Jane Eyre with dragons. And then, wow, what a concept. But the reason I bring him up is the first time I ever wrote anything for him, it was a series called Shockers.
Ah, yes. I love Shockers.
He wanted some ideas for the series. And I remembered something I'd written way back when I was a teenager about a vampire hunter. And I thought, well, there's a good one. And this story that I had written as a three-page short story back in 60-something, then became a real book. I don't forget my ideas. If they're any good, I hang on to them and reuse them eventually. Craig was brilliant at that. Craig was really good, and I really miss him.
So he inspired the Dragonholm books by just saying, Jane Eyre and dragons.
Jane Eyre and dragons. And that was it. And turns out that actually came probably my most popular book in many ways. I've certainly got more fan mail on it. And a lot of people still, to this day, will say, oh, I read Dragonholm as a teenager and it really influenced me. And I'm still quite surprised by this because it was certainly a favorite book of mine. But, the writers don't always know what their best stuff is. They know what they like best, but that's not necessarily the same thing. But I was really amazed by it. A lot of people would come up to me and say, I love Dragonholm. When's the next one coming out? So I eventually did do two more. But this was Craig Walker, and Craig was absolutely brilliant like that. I did Diadem for him as well. And Diadem was another one. He came to me and said, we want to do a series of books based around the idea of computer games. Only I'm not sure how to do it. So it was just playing. We were playing a lot of the time. It was great fun. And Craig was brilliant because he would have meetings, not just with me, but with the art director and the various other people who would be working on the book. And he would throw ideas out and then people would get inspired. We were discussing the covers for Diadem. And the art director goes, wait a minute. All these books, they carry on one to another, don't they? And we said, yeah. I said, how about we do the covers so that the covers carry on as well? And he came up with the concept of spreading one big picture over six books. And it was because of Craig, because Craig was doing these things. And that was how he was. He would inspire people to come up with creative ideas, and he would just throw concepts at people and let it sink in and come to a boil, and you get all enthusiastic and want to do this stuff because of him.
That's wonderful. Those are the kinds of people you want to be able to connect with and work with and build on.
On Diadem, his assistant editor was David Levithan. Now, David Levithan nowadays is a senior editor, I should think, at Scholastic. But he was responsible for signing up The Hunger Games. That was one of his projects. So Craig's legacy, if you like, is being passed down from what we were doing in the 80s and 90s to what's going on nowadays. It's still in a direct line of descent. So that's quite fascinating, I think.
It is, and it's wonderful to be able to look back on it. And this is how these projects evolved with somebody at the helm like that who kind of really got it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, he was the perfect editor for me because, as I say, he would just call me up and throw an idea at me and then let it simmer, which usually didn't take very long in my case because he would just inspire you. He was very good at that. He knew what he was doing and he knew how to get the best out of people. And how can you not like an editor like that?
For sure.
Well, that's why when I talk to people, I always try and credit my editors, at least the ones that have been helpful, not necessarily the ones that aren't. But I found most of my editors have been tremendous people, great fun to work with. And some of them I'm still working with, and I still get calls saying, John, can you write me a story?
you've really become or became early on the kind of go-to writer for these types of sci-fi and adventure tie-in books and stories, which is so cool.
Yeah, well, my editor on the Carmen Sandiego series, she was like, well, how am I going to turn a computer game, as it was at that time, into a book? And she's like, that's the weirdest thing I know. Who is the weirdest writer I know? And then, John.
I think it's great to be that person, though. I think there's something wonderful about being that guy that people are
Yeah,
like.
it is. It makes me feel very happy, and I'm very pleased to do things. I do strange things as a result of which, but strange is not necessarily bad. Although in one case there was a bad. They wanted to do a Carmen Sandiego calendar, and the idea for the calendar was that each month you would have a clue, and the clue would add up at the end of the year to a question you had to answer to tell you where in the world Carmen Sandiego was. So I had to come up with all these things to put it into the calendar and everything, and put all these different clues in them and what have you. And they were going to have the calendar illustrated by an artist, and I would have to tell them exactly what he had to draw. I'd have something like Madagascan grave marker, and they'd say, "What the heck is a Madagascan grave marker?" So I'd have to find a picture on the internet somewhere and send it to them to show them what one looked like so they could draw one. I enjoyed doing it, but it took so long and so much work. So they came to me and said, "You want to do the next one, John?" And I said, "No." It's the only time I've ever turned something down very firmly like that. There was no way I was doing another calendar. One of my friends was a lady called Margaret Wanda Bonanno, who wrote some Star Trek novels. And she came to me one day and said, "I'm doing this new series, and it's called The Young Astronauts. They need a book in a hurry, and I can't do it. Can you?" Oddly enough, at the time, I was actually free for, I had like 3 weeks actually, no work, which was unusual for me at that point. But I said, "Yeah, sure." They got me on the phone and they said, "Okay, well, we need this book done very badly, very, very quickly." They'd written book one and book two, but they decided that there was too much gap between what happened in book one and book two. They wanted a new book two to go in the middle. So I said, "Yeah, no problem." And they said, "Ah, well, there is a problem, because at the end of book one, they take off into space, and book two begins with them arriving in space. So there's not exactly a lot of time for anything to happen." And they're, "Oh, all right." And then they said, "And there's another problem. We already have the covers for book two. So you've got a picture that's got to turn up in your story because it's already painted for the cover. And you have to have it. We only have like 8 days for you to write the book." And I said, "Yeah, okay, I can do that." And by this point, they're obviously thinking, this guy is either seriously crazy or he's lying to us, you know. So they're like, "Are you sure you can do this?" And I said, Yes, I've got an idea already. I'll tell the story in flashbacks." While they're sitting there going up into space, they're thinking about how they might have washed out of the project. And each of them had a problem which has to be solved. So eventually I wrote the book in, I think, 6 days. I was literally writing constantly, going to bed and then getting up and writing it. At the end of the week, I was just absolutely washed. I couldn't even think straight. I was terrible. It took me about a week to recover.
I can imagine.
But I managed it and it did get printed.
With stuff like that, where you're working with other people's content, I mean, especially big things like Doctor Who and Star Trek and Quantum Leap and, all the other stuff you've done, James Bond, how do you handle taking on this existing IP, knowing that you have to kind of stick to certain elements that they've already established, lore and world building, and knowing that the viewers and the readers, like these fans, because we know how rabid sci-fi fans
Oh
can be,
yes. Oh
and
yes.
like, how do you stay within the limits of what you need to do and respect what you're working with while still bringing your own vision, your own creativity?
It's sometimes difficult, but because I've always done projects that I've enjoyed myself, like with Star Trek. I've always enjoyed Star Trek. So I knew enough background for most of these things to be able to fit into the formula, which isn't so bad. And when I didn't know enough, at least I could get access to material that would help me. But yes, you have to really watch what you're doing. I mean, obviously, you can't do anything terribly seriously changing anything. You can't kill off a major character or something stupid like that. But the other thing I always try is to give the reader an experience they can't get in any other way. For example, like with my first Deep Space Nine book, I thought, what can I do that will be absolutely brilliant that nobody else could possibly have written? Because I'm sure if I come up with, there's been so many Star Treks, I'm sure that if I throw in just a normal idea, somebody's thought of it already and written it. So I wanted to always do projects that I thought couldn't be done by anybody else but me. And when I came up with the idea for Objective Bajor, I pitched the story to the editor as the Borg find Deep Space Nine. And he said to me immediately, no. He said, you can't do that. I know what'll happen. I'll send the idea to Paramount to see if they'll approve it. And they'll say, no, we want to do that one. You can't do it. What's better is create your own aliens and have them invade Deep Space Nine. And I thought, oh, yeah, much more fun. And went about and did that. But when you're dealing with a licensed property, you do have to bear this in mind. You've got to be conscious of what other people are doing in it. So you are more constrained. When you're writing your own books, you can do what the heck you like. I mean, that's not a problem because it's your own stuff. But certainly in the licensed titles, you've got to be more cautious.
The way that you approach those types of tie-in books and when you're working with other people's universes versus your own original stories, like, for example, the Diadem series, how do you approach the world building for that? Because for me, I love world building and I've written a kajillion short stories for a universe that I created and I got all these artists involved and it was just one idea after another coming into my head, or I'd see a piece of art that somebody did for the project and then I'd be, oh, that's inspired me to write a story about it. But when you know you're going to be writing a multi-book series, do you sit down and map it out first or do you just kind of see where things take you from one volume to the next?
As an example for Diadem, that was one that I did for Craig Walker again, and Craig wanted me to base it around a computer game. He wanted it to be kind of partially interactive. He got David Levithan to create these word games for it. So I would write the book and put in, insert one of David's brilliant games here. And the answer must be, and then give them what I wanted him to do. But what I did was I came up with the first three stories as a trilogy to work through the plot line. As we started doing that, Craig came to me and said, ah, well, we're actually doing six books. So we need another three ideas to go on after this. So then I had to start coming up with other ideas set around it. But the first one, it was a self-contained trilogy was the concept. And after that, I just thought, oh, what can I do now that's more fun? And I came up with three original ideas that made it up. Then the original plan for Diadem was that it would be a major launch for Scholastic. And we were all set to do that when all of a sudden they bought Harry Potter.
Oh, no.
And they took all of the money and all the attention that was supposed to go to Diadem and spent it on Harry Potter instead. There were no more books after book six. But then I thought, I don't want this to die. I like Diadem so much. I want to carry on. So I managed to convince another publisher to take over, which is not the easiest thing in the world to do. You know, one publisher doesn't want to follow another publisher's works. But I managed to convince Llewellyn to take over, and I wrote another four books to make that up to 10 books. I hadn't really plotted out. I just simply wrote them one after another as they came to me. I really didn't know what I was going to do until I actually wrote them. A lot of the time it's just simply doing whatever you're allowed to do and doing whatever the editor and publisher wants you to do. You have to kind of compromise a bit.
Yeah, I was going to ask about how, given how much importance you put on enjoying the writing, like you don't just want to be a human typewriter. How do you balance that with that business aspect of needing to write something that's commercial and that will be marketable?
Well, for example, every book I write, I've probably got 6 outlines that don't get written. I've pushed different concepts on editors and they've gone, nah, don't like that one. And in some cases, I came up with an idea called Unicorn Academy at one point, and it was going to be about kids going to a school to learn magic. And then, of course, Harry Potter came out, and oh, can't sell this one anywhere. They'll all think I'm copying J.K. Rowling, you know. I mean, these things happen.
Well, in this day and age, would you be able to do more self-publishing now, or is that more of a last resort?
It's very much a last resort, because I don't like doing all that work. I don't like making covers. I don't like, you know, publishing the things and having to figure out how to sell them and everything. That's too much work for me. I just like write. So definitely, I much prefer it working with an established publisher, but it's getting harder and harder these days. Most of the major publishers just want to keep publishing the same old all the time. Luckily, there are a lot of smaller publishers nowadays, so there is still room for fresh material. But of course, they aren't as established, and they can't pay as much, and they can't publish as much. Simon & Schuster is probably publishing about 150 books a year. These small publishers are probably publishing about 3 or 6 books a year. So the market is very different these days than it was when I began. And I think it's going to increase in that aspect, that the major publishers will be folding or buying each other out, as it usually is. And the minor publishers will keep expanding, but they aren't likely to get as big a market share or anything like that. So there'll be lesser titles.
Yeah, that's too bad. It definitely seems like it's social media age. There's been a real decline, especially in the US. I don't know about other countries, but definitely here in young people reading for fun. The number of people I see who are like, I haven't read a book since high school. And it shocks me because I can't imagine not reading. I mean, that's my go-to for, I'm on a train, I'm going to take out a book or a Kindle, not Kindle anymore, I use Kobo now. But, you know, I'm going to take out some sort of story and read it. It really shocks me when people say that they just don't read for fun.
Yeah, I know, it gets me too. I mean, I'm constantly reading. I relax in the evenings with books. I mean, as you can see behind me and everywhere, there's books all over the place. I couldn't imagine not reading. It's a way of looking at life and a way of enjoying things. From my point of view as a writer, it's always fun to see how other writers create their worlds and what they're doing with them and everything. I think this is one way of gaining empathy, you know, putting yourself into another character's mind, trying to see how they solve their problems. It's some way of helping you to do the same thing. And it's giving you empathy for characters, someone who thinks differently than you or acts differently or is in a completely different situation than you're in. And I think this really helps people become more human and more thoughtful. Plus, they have more fun.
Yeah. I do hope that things will turn around at some point, though I do wonder at the state of the entertainment industry right now. With the rise of social media and the effect that's had on people's standards and imagination, it's kind of up in the air. I think the best we can do is keep inspiring other people, especially kids, to get away from all that and really immerse themselves in literature more.
Yes, no, I agree with you entirely. It's very important to get the people, you know, younger readers especially, into reading, because they can learn so much and they can enjoy life more. One of the things over my career I've discovered is, if you write a book for an adult, the adult will say to you, read your book, liked it, quite nice. You do this with the 6 or 7 year old kid, and you write a book for them, and they go, it's the most incredible book I've ever read in my entire life. And they mean it, because they're only 7, you know, probably.
Yeah.
Read.
I love
but
that.
Kids are far more reactive. And that's why I think it's very important for them to read, because this is something they can gain from. Children love books if they're given the opportunity to love them.
Is that why you do a lot of writing for younger readers? I mean, you've obviously done books that appeal to everybody, but you do definitely have this big collection of books that's very geared towards youth and exposing them to fantasy, sci-fi, horror, mm-hmm. which I love horror as a kid. And I think it's a shame that so many kids nowadays don't read scary stuff, because the adrenaline rush of a scary book is great, especially when you're a kid.
I think younger readers especially do appreciate the stories more. Honestly, if you look at what's written for adults these days, it's not as interesting. Adult problems, to me, are kind of dull, whereas kids' problems are serious, certainly to the children involved. I think that's more important, that youngsters learn how to think about problems and how to cope with problems, and seeing how other people cope with problems, it all helps them. I read a number of adult writers, of course, but I find that I also have to read a certain amount written for younger readers, simply because they're often more interesting, to be honest, and they're often a lot more imaginative and fun. Part, at least, of what we should be for fun. It shouldn't always be totally serious. And a lot of adult material is just so grim. Whereas with the children's material, it's more imaginative from the reading and the writing point of view. It offers more scope.
I agree. If you look at my shelf, it's a huge amount of, like I said, older books from when I was a kid that I still love and I still reread. And Bruce Colville's My Teacher is an Alien series. Mm-hmm. That was me. I was that kid Peter in the book. You know, I was the one that
exactly.
wanted to go off to the stars with the aliens.
Right.
So.
My favorite as a kid was Tintin.
Oh,
I love Tintin.
I still read Tintin all the time.
It's so imaginative. Each one is completely different. Everything, you know, whatever's going on in the story is completely different to any other Tintin book. He was always insistent on doing something new. And the imagination involved was brilliant. You can read it at any age.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that's definitely geared towards adults. Destination Moon is one of my favorites. Destination Moon and Explorers on the Moon.
Yes.
And when I was a kid, I had no idea what they were talking about with uranium and... and the rockets, but I read it now and I get so much more out of it. I mean, those I have those on my shelf and I pull them out and I read them constantly when I'm having breakfast.
Oh yeah, Explorers on the Moon is still one of my all-time favorite books.
Brilliant.
What sold me on it is the cover. A dog in
yes.
a spacesuit. I mean,
yes.
yes, a dog in a spacesuit. Yes, that was great. So, I mean, that's really the way to get people, I think, is just to grab their imaginations and drag them along.
Well, I know I've kept you on here for a long time, so I think I should let you go. But there's one last thing I want to ask about. A while back, I read an interview where you said you'd gotten fan mail from somebody who asked you to describe yourself or talk about who you really are, something like that. And you didn't do it. But you had this urge to write them back.
Oh, yes.
Is that true? That you're a homicidal maniac and now you have their address?
Yes. In fact, I did write a novel where the main villain is a writer who's feeding off his victims, his readers. But yes, yeah, I mean, after you've had so many letters that are very similar, you do get a little bit punch drunk and you feel like, well, let's be silly for this one. And then usually, hopefully, you catch yourself before you actually do it. But yes.
That was one of the Shockers books?
Yes, it was one of the Shocker books. We were going to be doing more, but then Craig moved across to Scholastic and took me with him. So
I thought that was hilarious, though, that
oh,
idea
yeah.
that, you know, we all have ideas like that.
I think a lot of writers do that. They have their imagination going all the time. And they react to things in their heads in ways they would never do in real life.
Very relatable. That stood out to me as being such a funny thing, because I know we've all had thoughts like that. I would find it hilarious if somebody wrote that back to me.
I know, but my wife looked at me and she said, Imagine you're a seven-year-old girl and you get an answer like that from some stranger.
To be fair, I love horror, so I was always looking for the stuff that would scare me. You know, the fun and creepy things in life.
Yeah,
I loved exactly. all that. Well, before we close here, what are you working on next? Do you have something coming up soon? Anything you're writing at the moment?
I'm always working on various bits and pieces. My new novel is called Unstoppable, which should be out at any time now. And then I'm actually taking a little bit of a break before I start on my next one. But there's always things to do. There's always things keeping me busy. Somebody always eventually comes in and says, would you like to write me a story? And then I'm off. You know, that's how it always is.
Well, like I said, I've been following your work for so long. You were one of my earliest inspirations as a writer. So I really appreciate you taking this time to talk to me about all the great stuff we've done.
This has been a lot of fun. It's been a great time.
Thank you so much, John. This has been such a privilege, and I cannot wait to read your next book. Once again, John's latest book is called Unstoppable. It's out now, and I've included links to that and some of his other work in the description. I very much recommend checking them out because he's got a wonderful imagination, and his stories are always so much fun to read at any age. He's someone whose work I have enjoyed my whole life, and I know many other people my age who can say the same, including those who've been sharing his books with their kids now. So talking to him today was such a joy. Thank you so much for listening to The Art of Imagination, and I hope we'll see you again next time.